explanation about this session, because there is a history to it and there is a dimension to it that's not often true for me at the presentations at Holden. The North Pacific District of the American Lutheran Church begins to meet tomorrow morning in Portland, and Jim Fish and Kay and Mary and I are to go representing Holden and the Fullness of God congregation here at Holden. And the convention committee asked me to make a presentation at that convention. The theme of the whole convention is Let Justice Roll, and the two modules, the two divisions, in which half of the convention will come one time to A and the next time to B. The one module is racism, and the speaker is Vivian Jenkins Nelson from the ALC headquarters in Minneapolis, an articulate black woman who speaks to the issue of racism, and I think speaks within the context of the Christian faith. The other module is Care of the Earth and Its People, which I've put as the subtitle, and that's the one that I'm to do. So I have responded to an invitation, and I have been given the title to that invitation. That means that the last three or four days, probably the last three or four weeks, but especially the last three or four days, my thoughts have been around that theme, so that you are getting the summary of that thinking. And I also want you to know that when I go to the convention, it's the hardest of audiences. It's half clergy. My least favorite. My peers. No one is more critical than a clergyman in the North Pacific District of another clergyman in the North Pacific District who's been asked to be the speaker. So I wanted to do it once to a friendly audience here and get my confidence up. To a certain extent, it's not at all a good title. The Care of the Earth and Its People means I'm to talk about all the problems that there are in 1 hour, right? The Care of the Earth and Its People. It's way, way too broad. On the other hand, maybe we can decide what some of those specifics might be. I was invited to an urban area, metropolitan area. The Lutherans of the congregations there were having a meeting, and they invited me to give a talk which clarified or listed the major global crises confronting the world today. Have you got that? The major global crises confronting the world today. I started the speech almost the way Rich Kemmerer does. Are there any questions? Instead of that, I said, would you all take a piece of paper and a pencil, and if you don't have it, do it, but don't cheat. So I'm going to ask you to do that now. If you have a piece of paper or a pencil, do it, and if you don't have paper and pencil, do it, but don't cheat. You come up with the three, first three to your mind, major global crises confronting the world today. Just list them. What are the first three that come to your mind? Don't say them out loud yet. You've got 30 seconds to do it, because I want the first ones to flash into your head. Some of you are just looking at me. Do you understand it? Or you're thinking? Okay. What do you think are the major global crises? Share the ones you had with at least one other person, or three or four of you. Discuss it for a minute, would you? You can't flunk, it's whatever you think, so don't be afraid to give your answer. Okay, let's hear what some of you had. If you had one and the other person, or all of them, if you were in a group, or three or four, had the same one, let's hear those first. You.
Greed.
All right. We'll just take the list. You'll find that they're in different ways that you did them.
Say lack of love for others, and then under that there would be numerous stuff that would
that would evolve from here.
Everybody had that one? When you had it, did everybody have it? Okay. Hunger.
Materialism.
Energy.
Hunger.
We've got hunger. Yep.
Population.
Population.
Oppression.
Space.
Pollution.
Pollution. I think I heard also oppression.
War. Search for world peace.
War, peace, right? Think what you'll find, and there may be some more. Some people will tend to think more of causes like greed. Others will talk more about economic justice in the world, meaning the rich-poor gap, but you're talking about the same thing. Some will talk more about the need for peace. Others will talk about the problem of war or armaments. But what I found that night was, without too much trouble, we had five or six that most people agreed were the major crises. We finally said, let's don't take lack of love and greed, which are kind of behind it, but let's name the crisis itself. That clarified some. But we didn't have much trouble finding that we agreed on that. So then I said, why did you bring someone from West Virginia to give a speech when you all could have gotten together to do that? And I didn't mean that facetiously at all. Then we spent the evening with the next question. I said, how many of you feel that in your congregation you spend a primary time, or that your ministry and your understanding of faithfulness today is shaped by these major global crises? How many feel that your congregation lives with an understanding that our major global crises today, and therefore our call to discipleship, is shaped by the world's needs? And they said, no, we never talk about those things. So we spent the evening wondering why our own perceptions of the world's needs do not more shape our understanding of discipleship and faithfulness. It seems to me that the convention is trying to take a few of the justice issues. If you were at Rich Kemmerer's session, eye-opener at 8:30, some of the prophets in the Old Testament spoke to the justice issues of that day, and that shaped what discipleship meant for the people of God. Seems to me that that's the task. It's much easier to wax eloquent about the problems of the world. You can even get poetic, descriptive pictures of starving children. It's not hard to sound profound when you analyze the world's problems. It's much harder to give a gracious word of hope. One of the reasons, I think, is that we live in a kind of officially optimistic world. And the reason that an analysis of the problem sounds like realistic and profound talk, and that a word of hope sounds naive, is because we've heard too many hopeful, quote-unquote, speeches that are in essence just slick, just officially optimistic. They are not, in fact, realistic. They talk about everything's going to be all right, and they don't face major global crises that are part of our reality. I think we've gotten immune. Every 4 years at least, we just get inundated with officially optimistic propaganda, namely the two or three people who run for the presidency of the United States. You listen, and there's not a one of them who will tell you, if you elect me, I'm going to lay it out what it really means for the United States in the next 4 years and what's going to happen if we're realistic. They will all say, if you vote for me, things will be better, your taxes will go down, and you'll have three cars instead of two, and the Winnebagos will keep running, or whatever. In fact, in the last election, no one took seriously Gene McCarthy, so he could be a gadfly and speak much more realism than either of the two candidates spoke. And at one point, McCarthy on national television said, my goodness, if you listen to these two, they're the kind who, if they had been on the Titanic, would have, after they struck the iceberg, would have grabbed the microphone and say, it's okay, folks, we just made an ice stop. What McCarthy, and he is a gadfly, what he was trying to say is, We hear too many slick speeches. We do not hear enough realism. My hope for this convention is that somehow there is a mixture of realism and hope. Ruben Alves, a liberation theologian, says it this way. I'm hoping that kind of shapes the convention. What is hope? It is the presentiment that imagination is more real and reality less real than it looks. It is the hunch that the overwhelming brutality of facts that oppress and repress is not the last word. It is the suspicion that reality is more complex than realism wants us to believe, that the frontiers of the possible are not determined by the limits of the actual, that in a miraculous and unexpected way, life is preparing the creative events which will open the way to freedom and resurrection. The two, suffering and hope, live from each other. Suffering without hope produces resentment and despair, but hope without suffering creates illusions, naivete, and drunkenness. Let me give you another word of introduction. Some people there, good Lutherans, will say we have the wrong theme. Let justice roll. We ought to have the theme, let mercy roll, or let grace roll. No church today wants to pray for justice, meaning, give us, Lord, all of us, what we deserve. Do you want to pray that? We don't cry out for justice, we cry out for mercy, right? The whole point of the gospel is instead of getting what we deserve, we got his undeserved love. That's what grace is. I think, however, biblically, there is good reason to talk about the concept of justice. Justice is, what does it mean to you? What's the first word you think of? Justice. Fairness. Okay. If I were doing the racism seminar and we were talking justice, I'd take that old cliche, you can't legislate love. Remember that one? You can't legislate morals. The answer is, maybe not, but you can legislate some justice. You can't make your neighbor love a black, but you can make it against the law to refuse to sell only because their skin is black. Can you not? All right. There are levels at which you can talk about injustice in the world simply because it just isn't fair. Some third, fourth, fifth world nations are saying to the big powers, we don't want your charity, just stop cheating us. And I think we have to hear that. I think we have to try to understand why somebody who has been receiving our foreign aid says we don't want it. We want you only to stop cheating. Whether the Convention Planning Committee knew it or not, by picking the earth and its people, they have reflected what is now about 5 or 6 years of history of people trying to pinpoint the major global crises, and they have come to those two issues as the major ones confronting us today. Let me give you a little history on that. In 1972, in a magazine called The Ecologist, which is not well read by many people, anybody here ever read the magazine called The Ecologist? See, I just proved my point. There was an article called Blueprint for Survival. And that article was a brief advertisement excerpt summary of what was going to be published as the first Club of Rome report. Anybody ever heard of Club of Rome report? That's very high for a group this size. I usually get 1% who've heard of the Club of Rome report, so you're an exceptionally good group. Club of Rome is the name given to a group that was brought together by Aurelio Pace, an Italian industrialist and futurist. You would know his two companies that he's worked for, Fiat Cars and Olivetti Typewriters. A good thinker, and he thought it was time to get a group of people who didn't have any axe to grind, who were simply good in their fields, like the Green Revolution and the possibility for fertilizer and population people, and pollution people, and people who knew the limits to the Earth's natural resources, get together and say, how do we stand as a human race? How do things look? The first Club of Rome report, Limits to Growth, came out in 72. The second Club of Rome report, Mankind at the Turning Point, came out in 74. Let me just briefly say what these reports did. These people took their own expertise in their own field and combined it with the possibilities of computer scenarios. I don't know enough about computers to know what that means, but I do know that very quickly you can feed in variables and find out what will happen if. What will happen if we get to a certain point within 5 years? How does that look if you project it 50? If we solve it in 3, how much help does it do at the other end? If we wait 10, what does it do in the long-term cost? You see what I mean? You can feed variables much faster than we ever could before. And they did it with these various issues. The easiest one is population. Population in billions, time in years, 1500, 1800, 19, the year 2000, from the beginning of time until what year, give a guess, was it until we had a billion people living on the earth at one time? Anybody know when we reached that? 1830, good. 1830 is when you get this line, which goes very slowly for a while, up to 0.1. The second billion took 100 years. So the line dramatically goes up to where you get over here to 2. Third billion took 30 years, 1960. And the fourth billion took 14 and a half years. 4 billion in April of 76. If you project that, you feed in all kinds of variables about population control and other things, but if you feed in a straight line graph that has no variations, you soon are having a billion people a year added to the population. It doesn't take too long. And then you begin to talk about a sustainable society. The estimates are now that we'll have that there have been enough changes since Club of Rome that they've downgraded it, and we will maybe have 10 billion people by the year 2000. That means there have been lots of shifts. This was also the first place that Club of Rome was criticized greatly. The first criticism came with a clever, facetious comment. Someone said, oh yeah, Club of Rome ran a straight line graph on population. Well, we did that. We took the amount of horse manure on the streets of London in 1850 and in 1870, and we projected a straight line graph, and there ought to be 15 feet of it out there now on London streets. And they thought they had discounted what Club of Rome was trying to do. What they failed to understand was Club of Rome was not trying to predict the future. Club of Rome was saying, if there are no changes, this is the situation. If everyone had come into London by horse, and the population had increased to what it is now, and everyone was still coming in by horse, there would in fact be a serious manure problem on the streets of London. The point is, some factors changed, and the people who did Club of Rome report hope very much that factors change. And this is one where it did change. In 1972, Paul Ehrlich wrote Population Bomb. And within these last 6 years, for instance, in the United States, we are now below zero population growth. We're at 1.7. Population can change very quickly. Part of it is attitudes toward family size on the part of people who get married. Part of it is most of the young people I talk to today talk about 2 children, and maybe one of those is adopted and one is natural. Well, when Mary and I got married, we enjoyed cheaper by the dozen at the theater. And when that woman from Planned Parenthood came in and 12 kids came down the stairs, and she huffed and puffed and said, and imagine, one block from national headquarters. And she walked out, we all cheered the 12 kids, right? I mean, she was some kind of nut who thought that you ought to not have a large family. That's changed very quickly. All right. Club of Rome did this with a lot of things. They did it with our natural resources. They did it with the amount of pollution we're creating. They did it with the world food supply. The summary of Club of Rome was that there are 2 gaps, and that our major global crises are in those 2 gaps, and they're both getting wider every year. They said that in 74, this is 79, and they were right, and they're both wider now than when they wrote the book. The 2 gaps are between us and the environment which is our home. Between us and the earth which supports us. The other is between the rich and the poor in the world. And that gap is getting wider every year. Larry Rasmussen and Bruce Birch, who teach at Wesley Theological Seminary and who write books together, which is a nice combination because one is a professor of Old Testament and the other is a professor of Christian ethics. And those two disciplines don't always get together. These two write books together, and they have a new one called The Predicament of the Prosperous. And I will quote from their book. Two basic dichotomies must be resolved if our world is to wrest a viable future from a problematic present. The first is the dichotomy between the rich and the poor. Wealth and material resources, even necessities such as food, exist in a tremendous imbalance that cannot be defended as even sustainable, much less just. The second dichotomy is between humanity and nature, or as we would prefer, between humanity and the rest of nature. Part of our problem is humanity and nature and seeing that we're not part of it. To exploit the natural environment for narrowly defined human interests contributes to social injustice and is ultimately self-destructive. We are chewing up at a furious rate the material foundations of our life together. I've already said that it isn't hard to be articulate in discussing the problem. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. And I'm delighted to be part of a convention and part of a division of the American Lutheran Church that takes as their convention theme looking at these realities again. Let's look at them just briefly. Environment. The premise of Larry and Bruce is that this is a serious problem, that our life style disregards this earth, which is our home, and it isn't hard to give a long speech on how careless we are with the care of the earth. John Victor Taylor, an English bishop, has a book called Enough is Enough, and in the second chapter he says, we live like spoiled children. We assume that there are two nursemaids who will pick up after us everywhere, so we litter everywhere we go. We assume that water and wind will clean up after us, so we just litter. The limits to the ability of the water and the wind to take care of our pollution, we are almost there. The water off of Long Island 2 years ago had enough, and they spit back up with every wave the sewage which had been pumped into it, and those were the beaches in front of very wealthy people who had built their homes on Long Island. Now something will be done. If it continued to spew up on East Harlem or the river in New York, nothing will be done. But when Long Island gets polluted back, something will be done. We throw away in the United States, in solid refuse and trash every day, 10 pounds per person. Now that doesn't mean if you're a family of four, I can come behind your house every night and find 40 pounds. Always have to be careful with statistics, right? First time I heard Lyle Schaller, who is a church statistician, he started by saying, I am a statistician. Watch it, he said. I'm the kind who can convince you that if a man stands with one foot in a pot of boiling water and the other foot on a large block of ice, on the average, he's comfortable. All that statistic means is if you take the total amount of solid refuse and trash every day divided by the number of people, it comes out to 10 pounds. But it's still an awful lot. If you were on places on the East Coast, the West Coast doesn't feel this as much as the East Coast. New York City is filling New Jersey with theirs. There are films of the solid land. Some of the highest peaks on the East Coast are solid landfill. There are now some 300 and 400 feet high, and you don't have anything else that high in some of the parts of the East Coast. We have tended to think that when the Old Testament said have dominion over it, it meant we could do anything we wanted with this Mother Earth, and that's not the original meaning of that Hebrew. Rudy Edmond, who comes up here every summer as a geologist, has studied those sections as much as anybody I know. He says that one of the things that means is caress tenderly, and that's very different. Chief Seattle, who was in this part of the country as one of the Native Americans from whom we took this land, said, the whites too shall pass, and sooner than other tribes. If you continue to contaminate your bed, you will one night suffocate in your own waste. Not formally well-educated, but he had a good sense of the Old Testament understanding of living with the earth. I gave a talk on Club of Rome in Seattle one night, and when I was finished, a hand went up, and I called on this gentleman first, and then wished I hadn't. He said, the first thing he said was, obviously, you are a clergyman. And I about died. He was a very authoritative fellow. And he said, I am not a clergyman, I'm a scientist. I've read Club of Rome report, and I want you to know, and I want this group here to know, that I think we can solve the problems that they state. If we bring science and technology to bear, those are in fact solvable problems. And you could tell people thought, well, this is going to be a quick evening. But then he didn't stop there. He said, unfortunately, all of our solutions create heat. He said, we are creating a problem by solving the problems we have created. Are you with him? He was a funny guy. You have to stick with him. Then he announced, we're going to burn up. And he sat out. And people said, just a minute. I was off the hook. They were all on him. Just a minute, fellow. What? So he gave us a 5-minute lecture on thermodynamics. His point was, Club of Rome has missed our major crisis. Just living here creates heat. The more people, the more heat. But the new factor is we never realized a group of people could live with the technology that we've developed that creates the kind of heat that we have created. Let me put it in other language. There is a fixed heat threshold in the very near atmosphere, and if the threshold is crossed, it will affect regional ecosystems. It's called the greenhouse effect, and it's irreversible. There are people beginning to say, we're so close to that, that that's our major problem. And it's primarily our lifestyle or energy. This is the one that I don't have to say much about at North Pacific District, because all the pre-convention talk talks about, we hope you can find gas, please carpool, take the bus, we'll have shuttles from the train station, the airport, just call the convention if you can't get there by car. That's new for us, right? Club of Rome in 1972 said that's going to come very quickly. The Arabs read the book, we didn't. They understood it very well, and they still understand it, right? The Limits to Growth in 1972 said there is about 30 or 40 years more of oil. What do you think we reacted to? Well, how would you react when you first heard that in 1972? Most people said, we'll find some more. I don't know if that's what you would have said or not. Mr. Micawber said that in Dickens, didn't he? Something will turn up. So the Club of Rome people assumed that's what we'd say, and they said to the computer, find some more, as long as you're writing a scenario. And I think they were kind of optimistic. They said, find 5 times what we think there is. Do you understand what they did? We think there's so much oil, known oil reserves, that'll last 30 or 40 years. Let's assume we find 5 times what we think there is. Just assume that. You know what it did? It added 10 years. That was the shock. The other wasn't a shock. That was a shock, because for the first time, some people understood the exponential. That's a statistician word for straight line up. Straight line up. Exponential use of petroleum products. It is just out of sight in our world, the use we're making of it. E.F. Schumacher came to Minneapolis just before he died. Anybody hear him when he was there, Minneapolis? He wrote Small is Beautiful. E.F. Schumacher would try in every way he could to get that point across. And he would anticipate. He says, some people say, well, there's Alaska. Do you realize that within 10 years, with our use of oil, we'll have to find an Alaska every 9 months to keep up with our use? And he had a statistic that finally got to me. He said, 30 years ago, the total shippage of oil was less than we spilled last year. That finally dawns on us that we are in an energy crisis, because we've become so attached to one source, and it has been cheap. And at this point, if you want to look at justice, the United States doesn't come off very well. Half of the world's energy, half of the world's population uses only 10% of the world's energy. So don't blame the third, fourth, and fifth world nations. They don't use much energy at all. The rest of it is used by a very small percentage of the world. 6%, us, uses 35% of all the energy in the world. Do you think of Japan as a civilized nation with a high standard of living? I do. We use 4 times the energy they do. And we use 2 or 3 times Sweden's energy. Now we're talking about civilized people. By God, they're Lutherans. A step would be to eliminate our waste of energy, not drop our standard of living one iota, and we could cut 50% of the energy that we waste. It's simply become a lifestyle of waste. Those are the kinds of things that become, for the rest of the world, a justice issue, or the rich-poor gap. This is where it's the easiest to be either poetic or sound so profound that what you really do is end up giving people a guilt trip. And I don't think that does anybody any good. I don't think that does anybody any good. Let me simply try to state a little bit of the facts of that this gap is also widening every year. I think it's been almost 15 years ago that the United Nations used the term third world. Have you heard that? How many have heard the term third world? All right. I have to wake you up once more. When they first used that, and I guess you all know this, the first world was the developed Western Europe and the United States, primarily, the free world of the developed nations. The second world was the communist bloc of nations. So we had been talking in terms of this world was divided into the free or the capitalist and the communist bloc. They suddenly realized that there were a lot of nations that weren't in that kind of struggle, and they called them the developing nations. So third world was everybody else. It was very quickly seen that that was not accurate, to refer to everybody else as the developing nations. Rich Kimmerer and others of you have traveled, and you know some countries in the world where you can't say that. So the United Nations began to use fourth world. Have you heard of that? I've said it twice today, but you've heard of it before that. Fourth world are the MSAs, most seriously affected nations. In order to arrive at who qualifies as fourth world, and in every country there's a few very rich, but generally, if you could describe a fourth world nation, they came with an economic way to decide it. That's sometimes not accurate, but it's at least a measurable. $100 per year per capita or less. Those people are poor. You can say they're happy natives and they grow their own bananas and they don't need central heating, but they do once in a while need medical care, or they need a hoe to plow their banana patch or something, and $100 a year or less, you're not doing very well. The shock was that was a third of all the people in the globe. Then that doesn't even accurately describe the plight of some, so there's a fifth world. That's 50 a year or less per capita. You live in a country that's landlocked without natural resources, like Chad. All right? The fact is, when we meet in Portland, we are a people whose house pets are doing better than 1 out of every 8 brothers and sisters on the globe. I mean that literally. In food, medical care, and shelter, our house pets do better than 1 out of 8 human beings. That's a time to talk justice, is it not? It's a time to talk fairness. It's a time to talk what is a disproportionate share for a few of the Earth's resources. This theme could call us to have and work for a just national product. What we have now is a gross national product, and that pun is intended. It's gross. And as viewed from most of the world, they are now saying the world cannot afford the United States. The world cannot afford the modern world. In two regards, the fragility of the earth in which we live, so the environmental issue is one of our themes, and the rich-poor gap, which is getting wider every year in spite of our foreign aid. That's the theme. That's the point. What do you do about that? I could spend the whole hour and give more statistics, and I think if I practiced, could have them just wrung out at the end of an hour. Just, my gosh, mea culpa. How awful. How could we do it? How do we atone? And maybe that's what it ought to be. The prophet sometimes did that. Just, you read Amos, and I could go there and call the women in the American Lutheran Church the cows of Bashan with their jewelry on. All I'd have to do is quote Amos. They'd never come back to Holden. I'm not really sure that that changes people very much, to just be whipped. Do you get changed much by someone who simply lays out how awful you are? I hope that it's a realistic look at justice, but I also hope it's a hopeful convention. How would that be? I think we have a biblical vision, which is a hopeful vision, and I don't think we've been living in it for a while. We have a vision of shalom in the scriptures. And I don't think there is a better vision for a justice-filled world than that word which is for us our peace. And I hope that there's some glimpse of that while we're in Portland. Most languages have some word for peace. There is none as rich as shalom. Irene, the Greek, means orderliness. Well, that may be helpful for some. Pax, the word that we think of most often, means calmness or tranquility or no conflict, and that's the one that we've bought the most. That's not the Hebrew. The Hebrew is, well, you have to walk around in it for a while. You can't give an easy definition. It's total well-being, wholeness. You couldn't talk peace in the Hebrew understanding of that and not be interested in the environment in which we live. The understanding of the concept of shalom in the Old Testament is that we live in a delicate web of interdependencies, including this earth which sustains us. When you get to the Ten Commandments, what's the reason for the Sabbath? Not only that you have a day of relaxation, but so that your oxen get a break. That's an understanding biblically. We don't have that anymore. If you take the baby bird, you do not take the mother. In other words, you never hunt to extinction a species, according to Deuteronomy, according to the law. And we disregard that totally. We've hunted to extinction two species of whales. We didn't even eat the meat. Went for corset stays, pet food, and perfume. That's true. That's a disregard of an understanding of us being connected. It's an Old Testament vision that says you can never do merely one thing. And we're finding that out. I can't even take care of my BO so that you sit next to me if I have a can, a jet can, because it affects the ozone. I mean, we have found more connectedness. Well, that's a biblical view in the Old Testament. And in the Old Testament, shalom, peace, is never psychological, inward, individual well-being. It's a social concept. And shalom is determined by how the least fortunate is faring in our community. That's new for us. I was the director of Lutheran Social Services for 7 years. And I don't know how often I got the question, which in essence was, if we support you, will you make sure that it goes to deserving poor? Boy, I got tired of that question. A Catholic priest friend of mine was more blunt than I, and he finally put it in the Washington Post and said, okay, forget it. I don't want any more of your used underwear. And he told the suburbs to just quit, that we'd take care of ourselves in the inner city. I know the frustration that led to that. I wish he hadn't said it, because that meant he gave up on some good people, but he just got tired of it. The Old Testament does not talk so much about deserving poor as it talks about the rightful use and sharing of those who have been blessed. Those are the deserving rich. Only those who understand that it's in God's providence, that shalom means only if all of us have enough. If you and I were Hebrews and we met this morning and I said, is it shalom with you? Do you know the first thing that would mean if we were both Jewish? You got enough money for today. And if you said no, it wasn't shalom with me either. This theme is a very biblical one. One more thing that I think is going to be necessary is to say somehow something within that hour of where you start. If it's so general that we say, these are the problems and they're great and we have a biblical vision and everybody feels better then, good, we have a biblical vision, and you don't have any idea of how that affects your life, I'm not sure you've done much. I'm going to try to do one kind of isolating of what I think it means first for us. And I have an idea this will be the most controversial thing that I do. More than a description of the problem, because I think people already knew that. And certainly a reminder of a vision shouldn't come as any controversy. I think we're going to have the wrong understanding of the word care of. I'm going to assume, and it may be unfair to them, and it may be unfair to you, because I'm assuming it this morning too, that we are so used to in the United States being the rescuers and wearing the white hats and being essentially the saviors of the world with our foreign aid and our food and our know-how, that when we have the theme care of, we're going to think it's another invitation for us to take care of the world, for us to be the good guys. It's the old charity. And charity, if I am the one who's asked to give it, can finally be a new input to my pride. And very frankly, I don't think that's what's being called for in the world today. I think, and I don't know how this will go over, but I'm not doing it in order to shock. I'm doing it because it's absolutely right down in my gut. I think what we're going to have to do for the first step is to understand that there is a God of history and that there is a God of justice. And the first step we ought to take is to resist the tendency to resist being stopped. I'm going to have to say that two or three times. I don't think we're asked to be the change agents. I think what we're asked to do is, are you willing to be changed? I think if there is a God of history, and my understanding of the Old Testament, and my understanding of shalom, it may well be that the new ball game is that we have to live more simply in order for others to simply live. And that's more radical than the 60s. The 60s had this premise. Let me test it, if I'm not correct. The 60s had this premise. Are you willing to share enough that other people can come up and live where we live? And if you were a reactionary, you said, no way, they're not deserving. And if you were a liberal, you said, yeah, let's give them a break. What we're saying now is, for a sustainable society, it isn't that everybody can come up to where we live. It doesn't even compute mathematically. We're 6% of the world's population. We use 35% of the energy. We're 6% of the world's population, and we eat a third of the food. We're 6% of the world's population, and we use 45% of the world's natural resources total. If you project that, if 18% of the world lives the way we live, you've got to practice a horrendous triage and eliminate 82% of the people. It doesn't compute. The answer is that our lifestyle has to be de-developed. And that hurts. The understanding in the 60s was, are you willing to let other people come up to the good life? Now we're questioning what the good life is. In the 60s, it was, is it okay for a black to live next door to you? Now we're saying, is it possible in a sustainable society for us to all have individual private dwellings with a white picket fence and a summer place and a Winnebago so that we sleep in style between the two houses? The day's gone. That day's gone. Can that come as good news? I'm not sure. Charles Birch says there is no chance of the poor countries developing adequately unless the rich countries reduce the huge proportion they contribute to the total impact. This involves a program of de-development of the rich world. I think I come with some people who are saying the same thing, and I will try to say that at the convention. Time Magazine, June 4th. When Time Magazine sounds like Coevolution Quarterly, you know something's happening, right? When Time Magazine sounds more like Mother Earth than Madison Avenue, something is going on. Listen to this. Maybe you read it. The weakness that starts at home. Anybody read that? Toward dusk, their small boats go whumping across lakes and bays, rooster tailing on fierce twin 100 outboards. Caravans of 8 mile to the gallon RVs start homing off the interstate. Their occupants damply chilled in air conditioning, bathed in Dolly Parton from the tape deck. In shopping malls, supermarkets the size of National Guard armories, people feel as cold as meat lockers. Housewives and pedal pushers go brrr as they load their carts with food encased in a wealth of non-returnable glass, metal, paper. They shake their heads as they pay what the checkout computer demands of them, pile the groceries in broad-beamed station wagons. At home, the automatic ice maker sighs and clatters in the kitchen. The automatic washer discos through the spin cycle, and the microwave starts the dinner. Since the early 70s, Americans have been flirting reluctantly with a complicated and grudging awareness about themselves and their orgies of fossil burning, but they are still in the quibbling stage. It's what psychologists call a period of defensive avoidance. Mary Ellen, is that good psychology? Defensive avoidance. All right, I'll quote you that's an accurate thing. The real calculus of American strength is not expressed primarily in terms of a willingness to fight or in its numbers of missiles and warheads. It's not expressed in how tough Americans can be with the Soviets or anyone else abroad. It's going to be expressed precisely in how tough Americans are going to be willing to be with themselves. A damaging slackness, a widespread feckleness have grown evident not only in American leadership and corporations, but in the whole U.S. society. The tradition of material salvation is the profoundest question confronting Americans. The logic of the energy shortage dictates cut down because supplies are finite. The questions raised about the nuclear power industry by the Three Mile Island accident only reinforce the logic. Yet Americans have not sifted through the questions of their priorities. They want energy without risk. They may be a long time in settling the question of what price they're willing to pay for their power. Americans historically have believed that they can have it both ways, indeed can have it every way. The success was erected upon a profligate exuberance. The problem is that too many Americans are accustomed to acting only in emergencies, and too few of them are persuaded that they will actually face one this moment. Presumably, they want to wake up to the certain knowledge of it before too long. Presumably, they will wake up to a knowledge of it before too long. As Samuel Johnson said, when a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. Time Magazine, June 4th. It seems to me that the role of the church would be to choose an understanding of shalom before it is absolutely necessary. In other words, to see a vision before the realities of the situation force us into something. Robert O. Anderson, chairman of Atlantic Richfield Oil Company, said at a conference I went to in Washington, D.C., voluntarily or involuntarily, we're going to see changes in our life. I think for most of us, it's going to be involuntary. I like to think that one of the ways you witness to a vision of shalom is to have those changes come voluntarily before they are absolutely necessary, because you understand them as grace and because you understand a vision of shalom which does not center on self but centers on being caressing tenderly this earth in which we live, and that my understanding of shalom is if anybody in the world has to say no when I say, do you have enough bread for the day, I don't have a shalom. And over half of my brothers and sisters would say no if I asked them today. I think, therefore, a church in convention is different from a nation sitting in its Congress. A church church and convention understands a biblical idea of shalom. About 3 years ago in Washington, D.C., I went to a conference for church and national policy. And it was an excellent conference. Some people who work in some tough situations of determining foreign policy and other things shared how their faith came into that which they did. They shared their struggles. There were about 80 of us there. One speech was really bad. I don't mean bad that he wasn't a good speaker. He was the best one in 3 days. Very fine orator. Everything was done well. I mean bad. It was slick, patronizing, slippery. At the end of that speech, the man chairing the meeting was a Lutheran layman who knew his hymnal. We still had the old red hymnal. When this guy finished, he didn't say thank you. He didn't take him on and argue. He just said, "We shall sing him 344, first tune, a cappella, standing up." Well, I'll reach for our hymnal. We stood. There were 80 people facing the speaker. He was facing us, right? This is what we sang, a cappella, first tune. "O God of earth and altar, bow down and hear our cry. Our earthly rulers falter, our people drift and die. The walls of gold entomb us, the swords of scorn divide. Take not thy thunder from us, but take away our pride. From all that terror teaches, from lies of tongue and pen, from all the easy speeches that comfort cruel men." And he had to sing it with us because we were looking him right in the eye. There wasn't anybody in that room who didn't thank God for the words of that hymn, because that was all you could say to a slippery speech. And there are too many pulpits that are easy speeches today to comfort cruel men. And it's a lie. I don't care if it's in the name of Jesus or not. We don't need any more easy speeches. The third verse is the hardest one to sing of all, because we weren't looking at him anymore. "Lord, smite us and save us all." Okay, pray that? Can you? How long has it been since you prayed to be pruned? I don't pray that. Sounds like it would hurt. That hymn is a beauty, and it's 428 in the red hymnal. Mark it down. 428, "O God of earth and altar, bow down and hear our cry." I think the understanding of that third verse is grace. I think it means exactly that. "Lord, smite us and save us all." That's hard to understand. That's the theology of the cross. Not a theology that says God loves a winner, and if you believe in Jesus, you'll have all the money you want and no pimples if you're a teenager and homecoming queen if you're college level. And that's what comes across that tube and the radio and too many pulpits Sunday after Sunday. This is gospel. "Lord, smite us and save us all." Dom Elder Camara, funny little bishop. What is he, 5'5"? Lives in Brazil, lives with the poor. Dom Elder Camara said, "The more we have to lose," literally, "the more we have, and therefore the more we have to lose, the more subtly and even fiercely we're going to find ourselves opposing the will of God for our lives and our world in the next few years." I think that's true. I think we have to deaccumulate and literally have less so we can begin to celebrate what a God of history does. I hope that the convention in Portland and the people in Holden Village think very carefully before they flippantly say, "Let justice roll." But if we really mean it and begin to sing that, I think there's a lot of power there. Thank you for being a kind audience before I face all those preachers with an attempt. And I didn't mean to ruin a nice lunch. Doesn't do anybody any good when we don't celebrate the good gift. Thank you.